Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, a very interesting, thought-provoking piece that is the cover story of the September issue of Harper's Magazine, in which the author says this. It's a lengthy essay, so this is just a part of it. Instead of treating higher education as a commodity, we need to treat it as a right. Instead of seeing it in terms of market purposes, we need to see it once again in terms of intellectual and moral purposes, and that means restructuring one of the great achievements of post-war American society: high quality, low or no cost mass public higher education. So we'll be looking at the neoliberal arts, how college, he says, sold its soul to the market, what it is people are studying in school these days, and how the purpose of an education may have changed. Well, our guest this hour is William Derezowitz. He is a former Yale professor, and he's author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. I would suspect, because many of you have thought deeply about this topic, what is the purpose of college, we'll get a lot of phone calls and other messages this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And that's how you get a hold of us. Hi, William. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me
on. Yeah. So when you went to college, what did you hope to get from college?
Well, I'm not sure that I had the best idea of what college was for either, because I don't think I had very good guidance. But this is not a problem that just, you know, arose in the last 10 years. But I certainly had a great passion for learning and a great curiosity, and I did the best that I could in sort of the groping way that I had available to me to find professors and classes that really turned me on intellectually, that really opened my mind, and more than just my mind, opened my sense of, you know, what I could do in the world. And, you know, I mean, here and there I managed to find them, and I managed to get a little bit of the kind of mentorship that I think students really need. But I think it's, you know, I think it's really hard, and I think it's harder and harder for a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. You start the article with these two quotes, which evidently were floating from banners at some fancy school that where you were teaching at some point. One of them saying the paramount obligation of a college is to develop in its students the ability to think clearly and independently and the ability to live confidently, courageously, and hopefully. And then the other banners say leadership, service, integrity, and creativity.
Right.
What's
and
the difference?
And the first one was a quotation from the founder of a college in 1926. And the second one was extracted from whatever latest version of the mission statement it is. You know, so it's just sort of a bureaucratic, you know, nothing. I mean, I think the first one is a beautiful statement. It's about, first of all, it's about colleges having obligations to their students. So they're not just treating students as customers and giving value for value given, but they're really thinking about what does this person need. And then it goes on to talk about teaching students to think better so that they can live better, right? The second one, leadership, service, integrity, creativity. Leadership, service, and creativity are the three biggest buzzwords in higher education. Now, you hear them all over the place. They come out of the mouths of university presidents and consultants and everywhere. What do they mean? Well, it's not entirely clear what they mean, but the most important thing to note about them is that neither one of those things is about thinking or learning. And I think the part of college that's about thinking and learning, which should be college, is increasingly less valued, less well-resourced, not even talked about very much.
And when you talk about education in the age of neoliberalism, what does it mean in the context of neoliberalism?
Right, I know. That's kind of a, what does that concept mean? It's not, I think, listen, it's very simple. People also call it Reaganism. Sometimes they call it market fundamentalism. It's not capitalism. It's the notion that there's nothing but capitalism. The public sector should be eliminated. Fundamentally, it's an ideology that says that our value as human beings consists of our activity in the market as producers and consumers. We are our wealth, we are what we can produce for the GDP, and everything in the world is valuable only in terms of dollars and cents. So So it starts with a very constricted idea, really, of what it means to be human, right? Mm-hmm. If being a human is just being a worker. And since education has always been understood as a preparation for all of life, that neoliberal idea of what it means to be human has reshaped and terribly constricted our notion of education. And it's not just college. It's also K through 12. And it's not just America. It's around the world. So now we've reached the point where we see education as being about nothing but preparing you for the job market. That's really important because, you know, money, jobs, those are also really important. But they're not the only thing. And they should not be the only thing that we do when we educate our children.
Mm-hmm. Well, as somebody on our Facebook page challenging you said, maybe part of the reason is because college so costs so darn much money now that you're walking into a workforce and you've got to be able to make money. So you may as well prepare people to make money because, as he said, you should have your head examined if you go into debt $100,000 or more for a major in liberal arts. Patrick on Facebook said that. It's like we're preparing people because it costs so much money that you got to study something that will get you an income.
Listen, there's some problems with that statement, but I think it's fundamentally true, which is exactly why I end the article where you started this segment, but with a call for free public higher education, which is what we used to have in this country, free or very low cost. And you're located in a state that built one of the great public university systems mm-hmm. that the world has ever seen mm-hmm. and has been doing a lot, like every other state, to dismantle it. Why did we do that? Well, around about the 1970s, when neoliberalism as an idea was starting to take hold, we decided that kids should pay for college on their own, that it's not a public right and it's not a public good, but it's a commodity like anything else. So we shifted the costs of college from the taxpayer to students and families. And that's why people are taking out, a lot of student debt. It's not $100,000, but it's about $30,000 on average, which is a lot of money. And of course this constrains people's costs. I mean, but that's not a separate issue. That is the issue, that we've come to treat college as a commodity. I think we need to see education as a form of infrastructure. It is our intellectual infrastructure, our mental infrastructure. And just as we've not been investing the way we need to in our great physical infrastructure, and it's falling apart, same thing with the minds of our kids.
You also, and I think about where the knowledge, we're not going to have knowledge in these areas anymore. I had no idea until I read your article that the number of students, we know English is way down, right. The number majoring in physics, chemistry, geology, astronomy
right.
is really low. How right. low is it? Why is it that low?
Well, it's that low because those fields are actually not any more practical in this very, very narrow way that we're understanding practical. Because that's part of the problem with what the guy on Facebook said. Liberal arts majors actually can prepare you very well for the job market, and they're practical in ways that are not necessarily immediately obvious. But look, we talk about STEM, right? Science, technology, engineering, math. But science, basic science, is not a practical field. You're not going to make a lot of money as a physicist as opposed to an engineer or a computer scientist. And because kids are sort of propagandized from such an early age, you have to study something practical, practical, practical. They're avoiding those fields too. And yeah, the number of the percentage of majors in the physical sciences, like physics and chemistry, is down even more than the number majoring in English.
So what are we studying?
Well, at the fancy schools that don't have vocational majors, they're studying econ, biology, which, prepares you for medical school, computer science, and engineering. Most schools have vocational majors. Business now accounts for 20 to 25% of all majors in the United States, just business alone. And then you add education, nursing, communications, and a bunch of other vocational majors, and you're comfortably over 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what people are studying.
Hmm. Let's go back in history for a little bit. You highlight in the article American colleges, many of them being founded as church-affiliated institutions. And then we had some of their mission taken on by these land-grant colleges, those acts of 1862 and 1890, women's colleges, historically black colleges. And this this idea that was prevalent in all of these institutions that we, you know, begin to teach Shakespeare to everybody and Melville to everybody and read great right. books together. And it's no longer the purview of the WASPs in our society.
Right. Right, that's exactly right. I mean, you just outlined this sequential creation of, for the first time in human history, first country in the world, mass public higher education. So we went from a place where a very small percentage of mainly gentlemen's sons went to fancy Ivy League colleges and places like that. And starting during the Civil War, right when we were, I was talking about physical infrastructure, what else did we do? We built the Transcontinental Railroad, or right. started to, right? Mm-hmm. Same idea. Mm-hmm. And then on and on. Finally, after World War II, the GI Bill, University of California's three-tiered system, and we had mass public higher education. Now, of course, this was about the economy, and it was about helping people get a leg up, and it was essential for creating the mass middle class, also the first country in human history to have a mass middle class. But at the same time, we always understood education in the same terms that had been understood for the WASP aristocrats, the gentlemen's sons at Harvard and Yale, which is this is a preparation for life. We want to create thinkers. And the really the key term there was we want to create citizens. So we're now enfranchising larger and larger parts of our society, people from lower classes and then eventually people of color and women. And we want them to be full participants in our political process. So we need to give them the kind of education that's going to prepare them to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a bipartisan consensus after World War II, an educated populace for the maintenance of a free society. That's how people talked. Now, what's happened with all of that? We don't talk that way anymore, and we don't see education in those terms anymore.
We say instead, oh, you're an art history major? Oh, you're an English major? That's going to get you far, huh?
We not only, yes, we do that. It seems like every adult has gotten some kind of memo
yes,
that says
right.
you need to give kids a hard time when they do when they tell you what they're majoring in. But also, we legislate that way. I mean, in your state, you have a governor who keeps wanting, you know, he wants to cut $250 million from the university system mm-hmm. and invest $250 million into the football stadium, if I'm not mistaken, and who wanted to strike language about public service and improving the human condition and the search for truth from the University of Wisconsin Charter and say, we're just here to meet the state's workforce needs. That's the perfect illustration of the neoliberal logic in the realm of education.
Hmm. It's interesting you should say that because we do an All Things Political show every Monday and we were talking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter, Washington reporter, the first hour analyzing why the governor's numbers in the state of Wisconsin have fallen to 39% approval now, where they had held really steady for a number of years, much, much mm-hmm. higher than that.
Right.
And nobody's really looked at this carefully, but the big things that have happened have been the decrease in funding for the University of Wisconsin system. That's the big thing that's happened in the last 2 years, and it looks like the governor has lost support because of that action.
Well, that's music to my ears. And you know what? You know what? If you look at the great state systems around the country, Texas, Illinois, California, the other ones are all big, much bigger states. And Wisconsin has managed to create this amazing system through, from what I understand, kind of a unique commitment. And it seems like that's still in the state DNA, and that's really great to hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you deal with the reality? Because I have the luxury of going to school in the 60s and 70s when and had a liberal education and just sort of fell into, I didn't plan to be a talk show. Thank goodness I studied liberal arts because it fits in perfectly for doing a talk show, don't you think? But there aren't many jobs doing talk shows. And, the economy was easier to float in and out of jobs back in the 70s and to try this and to try that. And yet I look at the young people in my family and I think, ooh, you're facing something that's very difficult because it's harder to find a job and you're going to find, and I think that we as parents worry about that. You're going to work, nothing wrong with selling coffee, but you're not going to be able to support yourself because it's a different workplace. So how do you deal with that? College preparing you in some way for a workplace, William?
Yeah, you know, I don't entirely agree with you in terms of the way you've characterized things. I hear what you're saying, and college was a lot cheaper when you went. But look, you were a liberal arts major. You had no idea what you were going to do with it, and now you have a great job, a well-paying job, a meaningful job, a job where you're contributing to society. This is exactly the kind of way that a liberal arts major can be valuable. Everybody knows that people who major in things like engineering and technical fields make a lot more money when they get out of college than people who major in liberal arts. What very few people know is that within 10 years, that gap has almost entirely disappeared.
Is it really? Wow.
Yes. And it's disappeared because liberal arts majors prepare you in a much more holistic way. First of all, the kinds of skills that you get from a liberal arts major are the kind that become more and more important the older you get, because you're rising higher in an organization or because they're the kind of soft skills that become more important when you're interacting with people more. It also teaches you to re-educate yourself, right? I mean, people will say everything that you learn now will be obsolete in 10 years. So what you really need to learn in college is how to learn, how to continuously re-educate yourself. Liberal arts major, not learning one narrow thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is you said that it was easier to float in and out of jobs in the 60s, and that may be true, but it's also true that the economy was much more highly structured then. And we're entering, it seems like a whole century, as far as we can tell, where the job market is actually much more fluid, and corporations are less stable, and new industries are being invented. And it's actually, I mean, a lot of people have said this, people who studied this and written about this, that it's going to become more and more important to have those kinds of soft skills, to have the kind of mind that can do different things and change tracks. You know, I mean, it used to be that you'd have one career. Now you have maybe six or seven, right? This is the future that's being projected for us, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if you're just preparing yourself for that first job, you actually may be preparing yourself very badly for the whole run of your career.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Well, so we do need to know how to learn, right? And what does that mean? How do you learn to learn?
Well, I think you learn to learn by taking a very rigorous college curriculum, right? By studying the hardest stuff, which means liberal arts subjects. I mean, there's this notion that liberal arts is soft and fuzzy, but liberal arts means the sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities, not the vocational fields. So those fields where knowledge is actually being created. And when you study those fields, you have to think really hard because you're not just learning information. You are learning how knowledge is created. You're basically learning to make arguments. You're learning to analyze things, to synthesize your own arguments, to communicate. And also in America, we don't just study one thing, right? So you take a range of different kinds of classes that teach you to think in different ways. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that as you get farther and farther in college, professors hand over sort of more and more agency to you, more and more autonomy. So like senior year, you may do a big senior project that you have to conceive for yourself. You have to figure out not only how to do the research, but what research you should do. You know, and then maybe you write a 50, 60, 70-page paper at the end of the year. So now you've gotten to the point where you're learning how to learn on your own, and the professors have made themselves obsolescent. Hmm. That's what a college education should look like.
Let's go to phone calls. We'll start taking them in just one moment. Our guest is the author of the piece that appears, the cover story of Harper's Magazine for the month of September. I urge you to read it. It really... you'll learn something when you read it, and, you know, it'll force you to have an opinion and to think deeply about the subject, which is what is college for now, and what has the purpose of education become in a neoliberal age? If it is to, as our guest says, produce producers, is that really what college should be all about? William Derezowitz is with us. He's a former Yale professor and author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite, and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And we'll be with you in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and we start with Peter in Appleton. Hello. Hi, Peter. You want to turn your radio down, please? Peter. Peter, please turn your radio down. We'll give you time to do that and go instead first to Andrew in Franklin. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Great show. Just wanted to say that, you know, I'm all for colleges, and I think it's great. It's too bad that they're expensive now, but that's just the way it is. Sometimes I just feel bad when, you know, I'm talking to somebody, and let's say they're going through, like, a Civil War class, and then all of a sudden I say, oh, well, you know, how many people died in the Civil War? And, you know, the kid will say, oh, I don't really know, you know. And I think to myself, well, didn't you just finish the class? Well, yeah, but, you know, I wasn't really, you know, I'm just doing it for the credit, you know. And I feel bad sometimes because I think that, you know, some people just go to college literally for that degree, you know, rather than for the degree and to learn, you know, all sorts of things, you know. Sometimes I feel like they almost, once they get through the class, they forget it, and then that's it. You know, they got the credit, it's done. So sometimes I just feel bad that it's like that, and I think we need to retain more of the knowledge, which I think is, you know, good for everybody. So, well, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for the call. William.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100% with Andrew. I would only say it's really important not to make this sound like we're, you know, ragging on young people. They don't want to learn. If they see, and listen, I would say the vast majority of students, as far as I can tell, go to college to get the degree and not because they want to learn. But it's not because they're naturally incurious. It's certainly not because they're unintelligent. It's because they've been taught from the moment they got to school in first grade that that's what school is about, because this is the message we communicate to kids now. So it's not surprising that they have a very kind of cynical or instrumental idea of what education is for. And he's right. It's really a shame, because it's still possible, if you want, to get a really good education at a lot of colleges and universities around this country. And there are lots of professors and instructors who want to help you get one.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be there anyway, and you're paying all this money anyway. But we need, you know, we need to help them see that.
Well, and then you also remind us of all these really pressing issues, you know, climate change and resource depletion and the plight of immigrants and refugees. I mean, the issues that we're facing now are so substantial, and we really need bright minds, inquisitive minds, learned minds to take on these issues. And it seems as though a lot of young people are ready to take them on. We need to educate them for the task.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear about that. And I agree with you. I think that this rising generation really is much more concerned about the fate of the world than we've been for a while. What I'm talking about in that part of the essay is that we prepare kids, we prepare young people to occupy places in society as they exist. And that can include, gee, I see this problem in the world and I want to go to work on it. But the way we have them think about that is in this kind of narrowly technical or technocratic way. Like, I see a problem and I'm going to try to figure out a fix. You know, we talk about a fix for it. What we don't do, and what youth, you know, used to be understood as the responsibility of youth for a long time, was not just to fix the world in this way or that way, but to imagine a different world, to imagine the
yes.
next world that
right.
we're going to inhabit. So to think things through in a much more fundamental way, which requires much more than a technocratic education. And again, that's another idea that's been withdrawn. Because, you know, you're preparing kids for the market, so the market is what it is, right? You don't...
Mm-hmm.
It's not about thinking beyond the market.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, thanks for the call. Let's go to Nancy next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I attended UW-Madison in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and a program that I participated in, it was called the Integrated Liberal Studies Program. I don't know if it'd still be there or not, but it was a way of... getting students of that broad liberal background. It was a two-year program, as I recall, and then from there you launched into a major. And I think it speaks to a lot of the issues that you're talking about this afternoon.
It sounds like a great program. I wish I knew whether it still existed. There are programs like that around the country. I think it's a great, it's sort of a great way to structure college, to have those first couple of years where you're really doing liberal arts studies intensively, and then, you know, you sort of slowly figure out what you want to major in. My impression is that they've gotten weaker in a lot of schools, and it's precisely because schools feel like they have to cater to what students come in wanting. You know, even though 18-year-olds are not necessarily very good at knowing what they should want, at a lot of schools, you know, there are, you know, distribution majors, distribution requirements, rather, where you have to check the boxes. But like our last caller, Andrew, said, you know, a lot of times students just, they just feel they have to get it out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Thanks, Nancy. Let's talk a little bit about pre-college, too, because there is, and there have been so many complaints from teachers that what they're doing is, you know, they have to skip chapters on World War II because they've got a test that's coming up, or
yeah,
you want to read a book and you can't because you got the English whatever test, because there are so many of them coming up. There really is a focus now that is not on learning, but more, as you say, as if knowledge were an assemblage of methods and facts.
Right.
Informational texts in English so we can answer the questions correctly. The
right.
focus goes much, much earlier than college on what you're about.
No, absolutely. As I said before, this is not just college. This is an attitude that's pervaded education. I'm for rigor in K through 12, and I'm for accountability and standards. But the way those things have been implemented has generally, in my view, been really detrimental, because you get teachers teaching to the test. You get a narrowing of subject ranges because the test tends to be in math and reading, and
right.
so you don't get science and social science. But more fundamentally, the notion of what learning is about. You know, I weep when I hear how great works of literature are taught. You know, they read Romeo and Juliet, and then they read an article about teen suicide.
Oh,
well,
no.
No, Romeo and Juliet is not an op-ed about teen suicide.
Oh.
It's a complex work of art. It's about two teenagers who are in love. It seems to me that it shouldn't be that hard to get high school students to really get into it, but you need to have the time to do that and not worry about some another stupid test that's coming down the pike.
Nathan in Williams Bay, hi. Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
Yes.
So, just I wanted to testify about the doctors. I haven't read your piece yet, doctor, but I very much look forward to doing it. Just to testify to your point, I had a Bachelor of Arts in History with a minor in philosophy, and I ended up becoming an Army engineer officer.
Hmm.
Now, I had fully anticipated being going off and getting my teaching certification, becoming a high school history teacher, but the next thing I knew, my commissioning came back as active duty in the engineer branch, and I was quite amazed by that. But, you know, I taught myself how to use that calculus cookbook, and designing bridges isn't really all that hard. especially when you have other engineers around you, you know, who will check your work for you. And so I ended up years later meeting the general officer who chose me to become an engineer officer in the Army, and we were talking about that. And he said, you know, I didn't want just a bunch of pencil-neck geeks. I wanted somebody who could bring a background, a depth and breadth of knowledge to the decision-making process. And
yeah.
I, you know, my career, yeah. I was very successful. I was blessed. And mostly it was because I realized I have to teach myself this stuff. And I had been equipped to do that through my liberal arts education. And I would not trade it for the world.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that that's a really, you know, a really exemplary story. And the truth is that many of the more forward-looking tech companies out on the West Coast are absolutely looking to hire liberal arts majors. Obviously, they're also hiring engineers and coders, but they recognize exactly what Nathan was talking about.
And when he talked about teaching himself how to do things, you write about this real strong emphasis on extracurricular activities, which college students seem to be heavily involved in. Are those activities that add to their base of knowledge about something they may want to go into, so they're learning about what they might want to do not even on campus?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated. But, yeah, first of all, we need to discard the notion that extracurriculars is about, you know, playing softball or playing the flute. I mean, they're still doing that. But more and more, they're vocationally oriented activities, including internships, right? A lot of more and more students, if they go to school in a place where available, are doing internships during school as well as in the summers. Whether they're adding to their knowledge base, I think, is a good question. I certainly think that they're adding to their experience base, and they're testing out future vocational options, developing skills you can't develop in the classroom. That's not bad. What is bad is that the academics are increasingly de-emphasized. There was a big study that showed that students have been studying less and less gradually since the early 60s, and at this point study about half as much as they did in the early 60s.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, yes. And the same, I mean, there's a great book that came out a few years ago called Academically Adrift, and the subtitle is Limited Learning on College Campuses. And it's based on, again, very, very large-scale studies that show that a lot of kids don't learn very much when they're in college. And one of the big reasons they don't is because they're not studying very hard. And their attention is being pulled away by all kinds of things. You know, we have a stereotype of, like, the big state university where it's kind of a party school. And that's true, but that's not most students. I think in many cases it's all kinds of other distractions. Listen, including the fact that students have to work a lot more when they're in college,
right.
Which is, again, that's our fault. That's our fault. That's mm-hmm. the taxpayer's fault.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Heidi in Evansville. Hi.
I went to an alternative college, Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, in the 80s, and at that school there's interdisciplinary programs. There aren't any grades, and you evaluate the program yourself and the professor. And it was really, as you talk about learning to learn, that was one of the hardest things I ever did, because when I went to high school, and, you know, I had some good teachers, but a lot of it was, okay, get the grade, play the game, get the grade, work for the teacher, work for the grade. And when I got to Evergreen and there were no grades, I was realizing that I was working for myself. I mean, that was always in the background, but it became the sole motivation, was to learn and to experience and get the most out of my education. And I think that's helped me a lot throughout life. I think that the reason kids fall apart when they get to college and don't study very hard is because it's extending this childhood of, well, I'm just doing it for somebody else, rather than taking on, you know, responsibilities of learning for oneself and learning to enjoy it. I wouldn't trade my education for anything.
William.
Oh, I totally agree. It's a great story, and I totally agree with this idea that we're not, you know, by making kids jump through one hoop after another for as long as the eye can see until they get to college and then after they're in college, we are not encouraging them to develop a love of learning for its own sake. But more than that, we're also not encouraging them to figure out what they want out of life. They're always doing it because the grown-ups are telling them to do it. And this is really where my journey in this, you know, writing the book Excellent Sheep came out last year, but I started thinking about this stuff 7 years ago because I saw what the system was doing to the students that I had encountered in the classroom. They were really smart, but so many of them lacked a sense of inner direction because there was no autonomy in their educational experience because, you know, oh, we got to do the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. The next test is coming up. Mm-hmm. Why am I doing all this? I don't know. No one's ever asked me that question.
That's what we did in college all the time, sit in the union and talk about what's it all about, right?
Yeah, students don't do that. I mean, some of them might do it, but they're just too busy. They're just running around. It's just one thing after another.
When you talk, William, about college classrooms should teach you how to think analytically, rigorous college education requires you to be as smart as possible and to think as hard as possible. Is there agreement, widespread agreement, or is this a source of much disagreement? What materials you need to be looking at carefully to be as smart as possible?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of disagreement, but I'm not necessarily weighing in on that. You know, I know a lot of, you know, sort of education writers, or some of them will say, oh, the students need to read the Western classics in college. I'm a big proponent of the Western classics. I taught those courses myself for a long time. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying difficult material. First of all, humanities focus. So you're taking those subjects that do encourage self-reflection, philosophy, literature, religious studies. But even beyond that, whatever you're studying, it needs to be a class that challenges you. Another piece of this is that professors are not incentivized to put in time as teachers because they're rewarded for their research. So people talk about a mutual non-aggression pact in colleges. Or as I, you know, there was that old saying in the Soviet Union, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. My version of it now is we pretend to work and they pretend to grade us, right?
Yeah.
Grade inflation continues. Students are not being held accountable. It's just easier all around, except then you don't end up learning.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, thanks for your call. Ariel in La Crosse, hello. Ariel, are you there? Peter, I think, has returned in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi.
I was cut off there, and I missed part of the show. I wrote down what I'm going to say here. I'll try and be quick. The higher education, the purpose I was taught, and my parents are highly educated, was to find yourself by finding your calling, that all people are sacred, important. We're here for a purpose, but we must practically find a way to support ourselves and yet enjoy life. But still, each has different talents, gifts, and abilities. We're unique. And a gifted teacher might not be a good cop, or an artist might not be a mechanic. One more thing. I was offered a medical school, but I have no interest in medicine. You know, and also, saying each job is important. It's like a banker needs a janitor, and a janitor needs a banker. And lastly, I just thought of this up. I wrote down, we can't all be intellectuals, or no one would change the oil in the car. You know, that's all I had to say.
Thank you, Peter. I'm glad you called back. William.
Listen, I agree. I think he said that beautifully about the uniqueness of each student,
right,
and about the sacredness, if you will, of each individual. And there, again, I mean, he's saying the right to be educated in the appropriate way, whether you're going to become a professor or an auto mechanic. But I just want to say, listen, it's easy to say these things. We need to make a commitment. We need to make a financial commitment. It has to come out of our pockets, and especially the upper middle class, not just the 1%, but the top 10, 15%, which is, you know, that group is richer and richer than ever before, and paying less and less taxes than ever before. We need to make that commitment, and we need to, you know, put our money where our mouth is. And when we do that, when we enable kids to go to college for free, like we once did, shocking thought, they will be much freer to pursue their curiosity. And it'll be better for everybody all around, because, like Peter said, we want, you know, the best mechanics to go and, you know, become mechanics, and the best doctors, you know, potential doctors to become doctors, and people to find their role in society without having to worry about a huge tuition bill.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be a supporter of, as you mentioned, Senator Bernie Sanders, his tax on Wall Street transactions?
Yeah, yes, I am, absolutely. I don't know that that is the exact solution that I'm looking for, but yes, raise taxes, however we're going to do that, pay for college for everybody.
Thanks, Peter, for your call. We'll take more of them in a moment. What should the purpose of college be, and are we way off track? That's what we're talking about this hour of the program, and welcoming your phone calls. Our guest is a former Yale professor, author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. 800-486-8655. We'll be back with William in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Mike in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
I graduated in the mid-80s with a degree which could be best described as a chemistry major with just about a physics and math major combined in with it. And, you know, I started all my career pursuing that chemistry, the chemistry work. But I also took a fair amount of history, political science, some geography, and those elective courses, which went up into the 300 and 400 levels, has probably had as much impact on my ultimate career path as I went through my career, as did the science technology.
Mm.
You know, I work in a global corporation, have worked in global corporations all my career. And having the understanding of how to look, you know, that my history and political science courses, having to understand how culture impacts the people you interact with, and how, you know, the meshing of the cultures, you know, learning that from an academic basis, a rigorous academic basis, has really helped me, I believe, in approaching how I work day to day, which most of my day is spent either talking or working with people that have a drastically different cultural and ethnic backgrounds than what I came mm-hmm. up with. And I think, you know, that broad-based liberal component to my education is extremely valuable. And if we're going to compete in a global environment, it's absolutely where we need to be doing and pursuing more vigorously than just pure vocational.
Mm, I'm glad you called, Mike. Thanks. William.
Yeah, I mean, again, great words. He also partly illustrated what I was saying before about how liberal arts skills and knowledge tend to come into play as you move forward in your career. I'm guessing he wasn't dealing with those global clients when he was sort of first out. Here's the thing. The countries that we feel most competitive with, the East Asian economies, you know, we look at them and we say, oh, no, we must emulate them. We must do what they're doing, so we need to strip out everything that isn't this kind of rote STEM education. What are they doing? They're looking at us and they're saying, how come America, where the kids score so low on their tests, and by the way, we always have, how come they're the ones that continue to produce the new innovations? How come Google and Facebook and Apple all come from America? And one of the things they've figured out is that it's because of our liberal arts education. And by the way, again, in K-12, we don't use that term, but when, you know, kids in grade school and high school ask questions, talk about, you know, have discussions in class, voice their opinions, that's part of the same idea, and it's something that they don't do in Asian countries. They are trying to get a larger quotient of liberal arts into their system so they can be like us, just as we are trying to strip out our liberal arts so we can be like them.
Well, the other thing that happens here, and I know it happens in many other countries too, but in some it doesn't, is that we are required, as a member of a democracy, to understand to have this liberal arts background so that you can participate fully as an American citizen. You need to know some things.
Listen, I agree, but I will again point out that I don't hear people using the word citizen very much anymore, and certainly not in connection with education. They talk about jobs and workers. Remember, one of my big buzzwords from that banner is leadership.
Yes.
And, you know, leadership, I mean, we could have a whole conversation about this, but it's really saying you're going to be a one percenter, you're going to get to the top, and you're going to change the world or whatever it is because you're a leader. So effectively, the term leader has replaced the word citizen, which means that instead of thinking in terms of we all govern society together, it's the select few, the elite, are going to govern society for the rest of us from the awesome height of their tremendous, you know, intellectual and moral gifts.
Right.
And I think if we look at the leadership we've had in the last few decades, we can see what a terrible mistake that is.
Yeah, and you look at what's happening politically right now, and people are saying, hey, you select few aren't going to pick everybody for me. We've seen some dramatic
results. Listen, I think we're beginning to get fed up with all of this stuff.
Yeah. Mike, thanks very much for the call. Richard is next in Blair. Hi.
Hi. I've got a few points. First is speaking on math and engineering and science and decrease there. My background is in engineering and I'm a geologist. I find the problem in from tutoring, too, that students aren't being prepared in high school. Too many math programs have been dropped. It's hard. And I don't think it's the teachers in the school district. I think it's the parents not participating in the education of those students in preparatory for college. And the other is your speaker on the Civil War. I think he kind of hit the point wrong. It's not how many died, not knowing how many died in the Civil War, wanting to and knowing how to find out. That's what you should get as part of your liberal arts education in the science and engineering. And the other, in closing, I'd like to know what the speaker's background is in preparing for this.
Thank you, Richard.
I agree with Richard all around about, you know, obviously students need to be prepared well. And there's a tremendous problem. I mean, I know at least in Oregon, and I suspect that it's similar in other places, although we have a pretty lousy educational system here. But I recently learned that something like 70% of students who get to college need remediation.
Ooh.
Yeah. My own background is that I was a college professor at Yale for 10 years. I did my PhD at Columbia, where I also was a graduate instructor for 5 years. I left academia in 2008. Around that exact time, I published an article called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education, laying out some of the first problems that I saw with the system. And there was a really big response to it that I didn't expect, and I started to hear from many, many, many students. And so it became the subject that I pursued. And for the last 7 years, much of my time has been devoted to corresponding with students, speaking at various college campuses and hearing what they had to say, reading a lot about this, talking to a lot, I mean, professors write to me, parents write to me, HR managers write to me, alumni from all decades write to me, and then I worked on the book for 6 years. It came out last year, and I continue to think and to write and to listen about this stuff.
Thanks, Richard. Excuse me. Let's go to Ariel in La Crosse. Hi.
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 So I'm a current undergrad student at UW La Crosse here, and I'm a double major in archaeology and public and policy history. I'm entering my last year of my undergrad, and I'm definitely planning on going to grad school, but it seems to me that some of the points that your speaker's been making is that perhaps grad school is maybe not a good idea, because grad school for me has always seemed very much vocational-centered rather than liberal arts-centered.
No. I'm not saying that at all. I do think that there is a difference between college and graduate school, and that's totally fine. The role of graduate school is absolutely, you figured out what you want to do or what you think you want to do, and you go and get the vocational training, which can also be very intellectual. I mean, if you're doing a program in public policy, it's not just about, you know, learning a narrow range of skills. College is different. And I should also say that, again, this is a unique thing that we have in this country, that we see college in this way. I mean, in Britain, they call it university. And I think that's right, because in Britain, you know, you go and study chemistry, that's all you're studying. You're just already on a vocational track. We have this different idea, and it's connected with our notions of citizenship and our notions of freedom and possibility and potentiality. And we let young Americans who are so inclined for 4 years, the first 4 years of young adulthood, to learn and explore in an open-ended way. And it's one of the secrets of our economic dynamism, and I think of what at least used to be our social dynamism.
Thanks, Ariel. Josh Madison, hi.
Hi. I was an undergrad student at UW-Eau Claire, and I'm currently a grad student out at Madison. And I guess I just wanted to comment on some of the comments made about the lack of retention, I guess, for students. And as a student, I've found, I put a lot of time and effort, obviously, into studying, but because of the expectation always being about the grade, pretty much from the time you start school, you do what you need to do to make sure you know all the information necessary. And so what I find is I cram a lot of information, I process a lot of information on the short term, and I can do very well on the exams, and then I lose a lot of it in the long term. And so it's kind of a give or take, I guess. What I'm good at doing is I'm good at memorizing mass amounts of information, processing mass amounts of information, and doing it very quickly, but it won't stick for very long. And so I think it kind of, based on how we've set it up, there's this thing for me, is it more about being able to process a lot of information very quickly, or is it more about retaining as much information as possible? So just a comment.
Thank you, Josh. William?
Yeah, listen, I would even go beyond that and to say you shouldn't even think in terms of information. I mean, yes, it's important to learn stuff, but what you're really learning is way beyond information. It's about, sort of building out your mental abilities, which will enable you to find and to understand information, right? I mean, that's the thing. You can have all the facts in the world, but if you don't know what to do with them, you haven't really learned anything. I would also say, again, this is not just a matter of words. In order to give students a kind of education where they're not just memorizing and spitting back, we need to get away from the large lecture courses. We need to get away from this notion that we're going to teach people remotely by computer and emphasize the small classroom, just like we do in high school. That requires a lot of resources. When a professor is teaching 12, 15, 20 students at a time, it takes more money. We need to make that investment so people are really learning and not just being, you know, information sieves.
Thank you, Josh. William, thanks so much for writing the article and for being with us. It'll stay with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on.
William Derezowitz, he's a former Yale professor and author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I have to be off tomorrow, but John Munson will be in for me, and he'll be speaking with the author of Weed the People, and that will be on medical marijuana. So that's coming up tomorrow during this hour. Thanks for listening.